Shaw asked me to talk about courage today, at least in part because, as most of you know, I have been forced over the past year to stare my mortality in the face. I was told last summer that I had a cancer that was both inoperable and incurable. The words fairly aggressive were used, and that the average prognosis is about 2 years. Which side of the bell curve was I on? No way to know. Then, or even now, after surgery that removed all signs of the cancer and a recent scan that was clean. But courage? Me? You are looking at a woman who has only come to realize within the last 8 years how anxiety, and specifically her fear of death, has affected her entire life. Even as a child, I was acutely aware that we are all going to die one day. I have this memory of riding in our old Studebaker when I was 6 or 7 years old, covering my nose with my hand and telling my mother I was being asphyxiated by the fumes. No idea how I knew that term at that age. My fear of blood, sickness, and death led to my either feeling faint or actually fainting more than once, both as a child and as an adult. I can't count the number of times I've thought I might be dying. I've been a card-carrying member of the worried well most of my life. I recall an interview with an author of a book about being a hypochondriac. The cure for him was being diagnosed with cancer. Nothing like actually living out the mind game others prescribe for worrywarts. What's the worst thing that can happen? In my late 20s, I became a hospice volunteer, in part to face my fear of death. My first assignment was to visit a woman tending to her elderly father, who was near death at Vanderbilt Hospital in Nashville, where I lived at the time. When I peeked into the room and saw this old, thin, sallow-skinned patient, I panicked and felt lightheaded. I turned quickly, found a restroom, put my head between my knees, and told myself to breathe deeply and buck up. I then returned to the room, sat with the daughter, and listened to her as she poured out the stress of caring for her dad. I did this by carefully not looking at her dad. Was that courage? I don't know. In 2005, I wrote what I call a poem, a confessional poem, perhaps. This writing helped me reflect on my journey with death and mortality as a child, and how differently I had come to think about this reality as an adult. The impetus for my writing was the Terri Schiavo case, which was in the national news daily at the time, a right-to-die case about a woman who had been in an irreversible, persistent, vegetative state for more than a decade. Her husband and his in-laws had long been engaged in a legal battle, the husband wanting to let his wife die a natural death, and her religious parents still believing in a miracle. When federal lawmakers and even President Bush weighed in with their right-to-life positions, I had to work out my anger. So I wrote this. As each great auntie died in turn. First Aunt Biney, rhymes with spiny, and she was. Then Aunt Toad, rhymes with road, as in a car. And finally, my favorite, Aunt Maud, who loved children and never forgot my birthday. As each great auntie died in turn, I dutifully filed past the open coffin, not wanting to look, but unable to avert my eyes. The smell of roses, the satin lining in the coffin, the subdued lighting of the funeral home, the organ playing softly and tenderly. All this whispered loudly, "Do not wake the dead." As we sat in rows, family near the front, thick carpet under our dress shoes, I listened to the preacher recite the 23rd Psalm and speak of a house with many mansions where Jesus is waiting. Yet the truth I absorbed came not from the preacher, but from the terror I felt upon seeing my mother's tears. Death is real, painful, sad, and there's no escape. People we love enough to cry over die, and there is nothing we can do about it. Fear, anger, and I ran wild together in my child's world, where death was never spoken of above hushed tones, where I was left to understand grief alone, with mixed up images of heaven and hell, of Jesus the Savior and Jesus the Judge. Now, though, my fear and anger are reserved for those who say to suffer is God's will for us, that death is to be held off at all cost, that to be friends with death is to be an enemy of God at worst, or mentally ill at best, as if I am supposed to believe the world cannot go on without me. Death seeks me out and looks me in the eye. I meet its gaze and even smile sometimes, knowing the world can live without me, and without you too, my aunties. For when the time comes, as it must, there is thankfully, yet regrettably, nothing we can do about it. Last summer, I devoured the book, Being Mortal, by Atul Gawande. I have returned to it many times since. In his final chapter, entitled Courage, Dr. Gawande writes, "Courage is strength in the face of knowledge of what is to be hoped or feared. At least two kinds of courage are required in aging and sickness. The first is the courage to confront the reality of mortality, the courage to seek out the truth of what is to be feared and what is to be hoped. Such courage is difficult enough. We have many reasons to shrink from it. But even more daunting is the second kind of courage, the courage to act on the truth we find. The problem is that the wise course is so frequently unclear." Gawande continues, "For a long while, I thought that this was simply because of uncertainty. When it is hard to know what will happen, it is hard to know what to do. But the challenge I've come to see is more fundamental than that. One has to decide whether one's fears or one's hopes are what should matter most." That is a description of courage I now relate to keenly. I decided to say yes to major surgery because of my hopes. I decided not to do follow-up chemotherapy because of my fears. I will do follow-up scans because of both hope and fear. I can't close without bearing witness to the many role models who have faced or are facing their own mortality with a courage I can only hope to emulate. My mother, John's dad and mother, Heidi Siemens Rhodes, Mike Yoder, Willie Horst, John Blosser, Glenn Miller, Carolyn Shruckshank, Lynette Bauman, Gladys Birche, and so many others of you sitting here today. I also bear witness to the work of dear ones who have prayed with me, to those who have met with me, placed their loving hands on me while soaking me with their prayers, and to those who have prayed from afar. And I bear witness to the gifts of love from my life partner, John, and our son, Wes. Thanks be to God. Thanks be to Jesus, God with us. Thanks be to love freely given. We are not alone in our hopes and our fears. And because of this grace, this holy gift, each one of us can, when the time comes, face our mortality with courage.
And when there is a promise of a storm, if you want change in your life, walk into it. If you get on the other side, you will be different. And if you want change in your life and you're avoiding the trouble, you can forget it. So Harriet would say, wade on in the water. It's going to be really troubled water. This is from Bernice Johnson Regan's intro to Sweet Honey in the Rocks version of Wade in the Water, and they're live at Carnegie Hall recording. Today's scripture readings are full of horror. Continue reading more of David's accomplishments in the next few chapters, and I'm not exactly sure that courageous is a word I'd use to describe him. It seems back then that cutting off the head of a 9-foot-tall man and then carrying it around Jerusalem for show and tell was not a sure sign of a criminally insane man as it might be today. Be that as it may, I suppose there's been a time or two that I've faced my own well-armored, theoretical Goliath Philistines in my life, minus the decapitation. Here are a few snippets from my fairly protected life when I needed to be strong and contest being told that I was definitely going to hell. I grew up the youngest with 4 siblings in a farming community in southwestern Minnesota. The first 18 years or so of my life were filled with adventure, a balance of hard work and happy play, and unconditional trust of my family and of everyone like me. I understood that I was in a huge, extended family of Mennonites who would help each other out no matter what the circumstances. Then I went to Goshen College, and my somewhat naive bubble of safety began to slowly deflate, and it was up to me to figure out how to face a haven of safety that had turned hostile. My dad, in particular, was a teacher of standing up for what you believe, no matter what the circumstances, and to do so nonviolently. As a child, I remember questioning him about the shotguns and deer rifles in our basement. We lived at a dead-end road in the middle of 4 sections of land. Late at night, mysterious vehicles would sometimes show up on our yard, slowly turning around, and usually leave right away, but not always. Many of my dreams involved the unknown people in these vehicles, and they almost always carried guns and were trying to kidnap us or just get rid of us. Many times I'd ask my father, would you not even get an unloaded gun from the basement and point it at them, even if they were trying to kidnap us? No, he said, no, I would not. From this train of thought, I decided that my dad was very brave and that I too could stand up against injustice and dire circumstances, even though I might be tortured or killed. My dad was also a deacon in our church for many years and taught Sunday school probably just as long. He was well-respected, so one Sunday morning, when a surprise congregational meeting was called after church and he resigned from his deacon responsibilities because he could no longer in good faith support the pastor, it took everyone by surprise. I was nervous for him, but I saw this as one of the bravest acts ever, to stand up in front of your closest friends and relatives and say that you'd had enough and could no longer serve in a position with integrity if you didn't believe in what the pastor and a few others were attempting to do. So, probably in turn, one of the things that took the most courage in my younger life was to come out to my parents. My mother's response was, well, what did you think? We still love you. My dad, however, was not quite so sure how to love me. He discovered his love might be conditional. After quite a bit of letter writing, I finally had the need to tell him that I would no longer debate with him on this subject. He had taught me how to say no in a volatile situation, and now I was telling him the same. He, in turn, decided for a time that he could not visit my house anymore. In my youth, I'd had another recurring dream where I was surrounded by old friends and family who smilingly told me that they needed to excommunicate me. It was for my own good, they told me. I could no longer be part of the group. This dream came to fruition in my 20s and 30s when the Mennonite Church and this very congregation told me, in so many words, I was no longer welcome as a full member of the group. When Assembly decided to go on a 7-year sabbatical from all things LGBT, I rescinded my membership, which also meant that I technically could no longer be covered by Mennonite Mutual Aid Insurance, another organization I'd always known to be there no matter what. I could no longer, in good faith, continue to worship or take communion with a group of people who viewed me as inferior to themselves, and I was no longer interested in playing the game of, do you like me or not? This decision was heartbreaking. I could no longer sing. I quit playing guitar. I canceled my subscriptions to the Mennonite and the Mennonite Weekly Review. I resigned from my position on the board of directors for the Brethren Mennonite Council for Lesbian and Gay Concerns. I refused to listen to or discuss any topic that had to do with anything Mennonite. No, I was no longer going to discuss the issue. No, I was no longer going to tell my story. No, I was no longer going to listen to the other side. I was done. Eventually, I felt I could let a few things back in. I was asked to perform in Bluffton at Menno Folk. I wasn't sure I'd be able to do it, especially when I was told that the theme song was, "How Can I Keep From Singing?" and that each group was asked to perform their own version of the song. I decided to brave my fears and give it a go, but needed to leave out a few verses and write a couple of my own. My life goes on in endless song. My peers and loved ones question. They argue whether I belong within the church, their bastion. The storms that shake my inmost calm have quenched my hope. I'm clinging to those who love without regret. I rarely feel like singing. Through all the tumult and the strife, I hear that music ringing, but when I try to join right in, I feel the tears stinging. The well of sorrow deep inside grows ever, ever deeper. When my church to me was denied, it nearly stopped my singing. I think I've only been able to sing every verse of this song once or twice in the last 20-some years. The scars run deep, and the words seem trite, knowing very well that time when I was so low I could no longer sing. Interestingly enough, we're ending our service today with that very song. After about a 10-year absence, I heard that Assembly had changed and was now welcoming to LGBTQ folks. Barb and I visited one Sunday about 15 years ago and have stayed ever since. It took some courage to return to a place where I still felt very vulnerable, still could not sing, and still was not ready to play guitar. But I was stronger and healthier emotionally than I'd been when I left, and I saw only friendly and welcoming faces. One interesting phenomenon I experience here periodically, however, is that any time Assembly's sabbatical years are mentioned, or someone from this very spot speaks of steps taken to repair or prevent damage to LGBTQ folks by the Mennonite Church and by this congregation, it's almost a given that I'll start in on the road to a panic attack. Can one have a panic attack while being courageous? I'm not sure, but facing the fear of exclusion is a mighty hard beast. Here's a little something I wrote several years ago after the Goshen City Council decided not to add LGBTQ folks to the Human Rights Ordinance. Courage. In my life, I've been in several terrifying situations cowering in the basement while a tornado ravaged our farm, cowering in the hallway while my mother coded in the hospital. But at the second council meeting, when seeing the wall of determined men and Jackie Walorski wearing polished suits all line up way past midnight to explain why I did not deserve equal rights, this was my first time ever to experience a panic attack. While gasping for breath in the hallway, and as my arms went numb, I wondered how my psyche had gotten to this point. I've been in this volatile environment for 25 years. Why physically react now? The next morning at work, I was exhausted. While getting ready to mow, I found a forgotten bracelet in the cubby of the mower, a kid's bracelet with the word courage on it, which I still have. I put it on and wore it the rest of the day. All day while mowing, I heard Caroline and Abigail's voices singing, "Don't be afraid. My love is stronger. My love is stronger than your fear." Inexplicably, when I drove back into Goshen after work, for the first time in 30 years that I've lived here, I finally felt as if I were home. I read the above at a healing ritual in 2011, following the decision made by the Goshen City Council. Many Goshen folks, including many from Assembly, spoke in favor of the ordinance. Many out-of-town folks spoke against it. Two council members changed their vote from yes to no after the first hearing, thus quashing the amendment. Yet the visible support from those who had the courage to speak in favor was strong enough to feel as if I had been welcomed home. The ironies within the Mennonite Church still intrigue me. I've come through all of this knowing that we are all one in the Spirit, that we all need to be set free from our blindness, and that we all need to dance then, wherever we may be. May each one of us in our own way be as brave as an immigrant attorney, as daring as an orthopedic surgeon, as bold as a non-compliant pastor, as vulnerable as a transgender church member, and as hopeful as a chemo patient. And in the words of one of my greatest sheroes, Bernice Johnson Regan, "You're gonna die anyway. Make a difference."
Thank you, Wilma. Let's sing number one.